It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR and at www.wrir.org. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
And again, just remember, the ACA requires that you and each member of your family have either qualifying health insurance coverage for each month of the year, qualify for an exemption from the coverage requirement, or make an individual shared responsibility payment when filling out your federal income tax return.
Nancy Porcari from the Community Tax Law Project offers tax tips for the 2014 tax year and for your income tax filing due April 15, 2015. And during this week's News You Can Use, you'll learn why making childcare accessible to low-income families is good for our nation's economy. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 259, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and online at www.wrir.org, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's News You Can Use. The average annual cost of center-based child care for an infant is nearly half of the income of a family of three living at the poverty level. In fact, child care is one of the most significant expenses in a family budget and often exceeds the cost of housing, food, transportation, and college tuition. Last month, President Obama outlined a proposal to change that by making high-quality child care available to every low-income parent with a child under age four. The president's proposal means that all low-income families, those with incomes under twice the poverty line, or roughly $40,000 a year for a family of three, with children under age four, will have guaranteed access to quality child care. By 2025, when this proposal would be fully implemented, access would be expanded to more than 1 million additional young children. The proposal would be made possible by increasing funding for the Child Care and Development Block Grant, or CCDBG, the primary source of federal funding for helping low-income families pay for child care. Half of the families who receive benefits through the CCDBG live below the poverty level. Thankfully, the program was reauthorized by Congress with bipartisan support in November for the first time since 1996. The Center for Law and Social Policy notes that the president's proposal would also fund the improvements to state child care programs included in the CCDBG's reauthorization. Unfortunately, they also note that only 27% of eligible families with children under age 5 currently receive help with child care costs through the program. The proposal would not only make an enormous difference in the lives of many children and their parents, it would help our economy. The Council of Economic Advisers report on the economics of early childhood says that every $1 spent on high-quality early education generates over $8 in return. Making child care freely accessible to low-income parents means they can go to work to support their families and advance their careers. Together with the president's plan to increase the child care tax credit, which also will benefit families making more than $40,000 a year, the proposals will mean more money in the pockets of parents that they can spend on other necessities or save for the future. Affordable, high-quality child care is a national economic priority. In today's economy, when having both parents in the workforce is an economic necessity for many families, we need affordable, high-quality child care more than ever. It's not a nice-to-have, it's a must-have. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. Welcome back to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. We're here again at the Community Tax Law Project, speaking with tax law attorney Nancy Porcari, and we will be talking this week about tax tips for tax year 2014 filing, which is due on April the 15th of 2015. We won't be talking about the earned income tax credit that we spoke about last week. That is show is still available on the WRIR archive for another week or so, but we'll be talking about other tax tips. Welcome back to the show, Nancy.
Thanks so much, Marty.
So the first question about income tax is, what constitutes taxable income for federal income tax purposes?
So taxable income can encompass more than just your annual salary. Taxable income can not only include wages, salaries, or tips that you earn during the year, but also unemployment compensation, profits from stock sales or real estate sales, even winnings from the lottery, betting the dogs or horses, and winnings from any casino. Those would all have to be included in your income on your tax return.
So for this year's tax filing for last year's tax year, how much income does a person need to have before he or she has to file an income tax return?
So it's all going to be based on your filing status for the tax year. And if you were single as of December 31st, 2014, your filing status would be single for the year. And if you had income below $10,150 for the year, you would not have a filing requirement. For married filing separately, the income threshold is $3,950. For married filing jointly, the threshold is $20,300. So again, if you're filing jointly and you made less than that during the year, you do not have a filing requirement for the year. If you were a qualifying widower for the year, the income threshold would be $16,350. And if you're filing as head of household for 2014, if you had income less than $13,050, you actually would not have a filing requirement.
So what are the tax implications of taking money early from a retirement account?
The income you withdraw is taxable if it is a traditional IRA and you did not pay taxes on it when the money was placed in the IRA. And if you do take an early withdrawal, meaning you're under age 59 and a half, you're also responsible for a 10% penalty. And I think this is something that people, especially a lot of our clients, may not have been aware of, and when they fell in hard times, they decided to take an early withdrawal. And then not only is that withdrawal subject to federal and state income tax, but you're also hit with this 10% penalty. And it does apply to the part of the distribution that you're including in your gross income. And you would actually need to file a form to assert that penalty. So it's Form 5329 on your tax return to claim that 10% early withdrawal penalty. There are some exceptions, but they are very limited.
So we are sort of at the end of the foreclosure crisis right now, but I think this question is still very relevant. If a house was foreclosed upon, how does that affect taxes? And here I'm talking about something called the Mortgage Forgiveness Debt Relief Act.
So the act prevents homeowners who go through a short sale or foreclosure from being taxed on the amount of their mortgage debt that has been forgiven. And luckily, this act was extended for the 2014 year. However, it was only extended through the close of 2014. So we really don't know if it's going to be applicable to foreclosures in 2015 or any future years unless the legislation is again extended. But normally, when a debt is forgiven, the amount that was canceled is considered income to the taxpayer. So they receive a 1099 COD for cancellation of debt income, and you're including that canceled debt in your income for the year. But the act allows you to exempt that income from your total income for the year if it falls under this foreclosure or short sale.
Now, one of the biggest issues in taxes year after year is, who can claim someone as a dependent? What are those rules?
So there's two basic criteria for claiming a dependent. There's the qualifying child or the qualifying relative. And for a qualifying child, the child must be under 19 or under 24 and in school full-time or permanently disabled. They must have a qualifying relationship to you, which means they're either a blood relative, a relative through marriage, they were legally adopted or legally placed in the home as a foster child. The child must have lived with you for over half the year. The child must not have provided more than half or his support for the year, and the child must not file a joint return for the year. Now, you can also claim a dependent under the qualifying relative rules, which are a little different. And despite the fact that it's called the qualifying relative rules, the person actually does not need to be related to you necessarily. So the requirements for this rule are that the person must have lived with you for the entire year as a member of your household. You must have provided more than one half of their support. Their gross income must be less than $3,950 for the year, and they cannot be a qualifying child for you or another taxpayer. So if you have someone that you've been taking care of that meets these requirements, then it's very likely you may be able to claim them as a dependent on your tax return and receive the benefits.
Okay, now one of the very complicated things has to do with child support and dependency. So the question is, are child support payments deductible, or can the taxpayer instead claim the dependency exemption for the child?
Child support payments are not considered taxable income to the receiver and are not deductible to the payer. This is in stark contrast to income such as alimony, in which alimony is taxable to the receiver and it is deductible for the payer. Now, if someone wants to claim a dependency exemption for a child for whom he or she is paying child support, the child would still need to meet the criteria for a qualifying child for the dependency exemption that I discussed here. Or the custodial parent could actually sign a form to allow the non-custodial parent to claim the child on their tax return. And that form is Form 8332. So basically, the non-custodial parent would get the signature of the custodial parent and then file that form with his or her tax return for the year.
All right. So what I'd like to do now is talk about some of the major credits that sort of low-income and moderate-income people would possibly qualify for, starting with the child tax credit. What exactly is the child tax credit?
The child tax credit allows you to claim qualifying children under age 17 to receive a credit that is going to reduce the amount of tax that you owe by up to $1,000 per child. And there are six criteria that the child needs to meet in order to be eligible for this credit. The child needs to be under age 17 at the end of the tax year. The relationship must qualify, so biological child, stepchild, foster child, a sibling, step-sibling, or one of their descendants. There's a support test, so the child must not have provided over half of their support for the entire year. You do have to claim the child as a dependent on your tax return to be eligible for this credit. The child needs to be a citizen of the U.S., a U.S. national or resident alien. And lastly, the child must have lived with you for over half the year. So if your child meets all of these requirements, then it's possible that you could receive the child tax credit, and you would claim this credit by filling out Schedule 8812 with your tax return.
Now, a related credit, but not the same thing, obviously, is the child and dependent care credit. What's that? What are the rules there?
That has to do with working parents or someone looking for a job that pays for care for their child, and it actually qualifies also for a spouse or a dependent. If you are paying for care, you may be able to get a credit for amounts paid for that care while you are either working or looking for work. So the care must have been provided for one or more qualifying persons. And a qualifying person is either your dependent child, age 12 or younger, when the care was provided. You can also claim it for your spouse and certain other individuals who are physically or mentally incapable of self-care. And the qualifying person must have lived with you for over half the year.
Now, on the other end of the spectrum, there's a credit for the elderly or the disabled. So what is that credit, and what are the rules people would have to comply with to get that credit?
That's a great question. If you are age 65 or older, or if you're disabled, you can actually reduce your taxes if you qualify for the tax credit for the elderly or the disabled. There are two main requirements. You must be a qualified individual, and your income must fall within the allowable limits. So to be a qualified individual, generally speaking, you're a U.S. citizen or resident alien, and you were either age 65 or older at the end of 2014, or you were under age 65 at the end of 2014, and you retired on permanent and total disability, you received taxable disability for 2014, or as of the first of the year, you had not reached mandatory retirement age. So if you meet either of those criteria, you would be considered a qualifying individual. And then the credit also looks at your income for the year. And as with many other credits, there are some income limits in order to claim this credit. So if you were filing as single, if you had an income level of $17,500 adjusted gross income or higher, you would not be eligible for the credit. If you were married filing jointly and had adjusted gross income of $20,000 or higher, you would not be eligible for the credit. And if you were married filing separately and you lived apart from your spouse for the entire year, the income limit would be $12,500. So if you earned that or above that, you would not be eligible for the credit. But if you did earn below that, it's quite possible that you would be eligible for the credit.
The last, I think, big one is the education credit. What expenses qualify for the education credit?
There are actually two main education credits that you can claim on your tax return this year, the American Opportunity Credit and the Lifetime Learning Credit. They're slightly different, but essentially it focuses on qualifying expenses, which would be amounts you paid for tuition, fees, and other related expenses for an eligible student that are required for enrollment or attendance at an eligible educational institution. So the important thing here is that it was actually expenses required by the institution. So if it was something that was just optional, if you were playing sports or something like that, expenses or fees related to that would not qualify as a qualified expense for this credit. But it's possible that if you paid tuition or required books or other fees, that you may qualify for this credit and receive possibly up to $2,000 or so in a credit for higher education costs.
And another big complicated question has to do with the Affordable Care Act. Of course, 2014 was the first year that the Affordable Care Act was actually the law of the land and people were required to have insurance for the most part. How does the Affordable Care Act now affect the 2015 filing for tax year 2014?
The Affordable Care Act requires that you and each member of your family have one of three things: either qualifying health insurance coverage for each month of the year, qualify for an exemption from coverage, or make an individual shared responsibility payment when filing your federal income tax return. So many taxpayers will simply need to check a box on their tax return to indicate that each member of their family had qualifying health coverage or minimum essential coverage for the whole year. And examples of that would be employer-sponsored health coverage, individual health insurance coverage purchased directly from a health insurance provider, Medicare, Medicaid, or CHIP, which is Children's Health Insurance Program. So if you had that minimal essential coverage, you could really just check the box on the tax return and file it as usual. However, taxpayers who purchased health insurance through the marketplace and qualify for or received advance payments of the premium tax credit will have some extra steps to take when filing their tax return. So basically, if you bought coverage through the health insurance marketplace, you should be receiving a Form 1095A Health Insurance Marketplace Statement from your marketplace by early February. This form has very important information needed to complete your tax return, so you do not want to lose that form. But basically, if you benefited from advance payments of the premium tax credit, you must file a federal income tax return, and you will need to reconcile those advance payments with the amount of premium tax credit that you're entitled to based on your actual income. When you file your return, you will complete IRS Form 8962, which is premium tax credit, to calculate your premium tax credit and reconcile the credit with any advance payments you receive during the year using the information reported to you from your marketplace on that Form 1095. Now, if you received a higher advance premium tax credit than you were entitled to, you may end up owing money back to the IRS, or if you're due a refund, your refund may be reduced. Now, that's if you had health insurance coverage for the year. If you did not have health insurance coverage for the year, you may be eligible to claim an exemption from the requirement to have coverage. If you qualify for an exemption, you do need to complete the new IRS form 8965, which is health coverage exemptions, when you file your tax return. You must apply for some exemptions through the marketplace, some through the IRS, and some you can actually claim when you file your tax return. If you apply for and receive an exemption from the marketplace, you'll receive an exemption certificate number to include when you file your taxes. If you have applied for an exemption through the marketplace and are still waiting for a response, you can actually just put pending on your tax return where you would normally put your exemption certificate number. So far I've covered qualifying health insurance and qualifying for an exemption. But what if you didn't get health insurance, you didn't qualify for an exemption, you're actually going to be responsible for the individual shared responsibility payment. And I'll just talk a little bit about that. If you do not have qualifying coverage or an exemption for each month of the year, you will need to make an individual shared responsibility payment when you file your tax return for choosing not to purchase coverage. And for tax year 2014, the annual payment amount is going to be the greater of 1% of your household income that's above the tax return threshold for your filing status. So if you were married filing jointly, the 1% of your income that was above the $20,300 filing threshold could possibly be your shared responsibility payment, or your family's flat dollar amount, which is calculated by multiplying $95 per adult and $47.50 per child. And they are going to max that out at $285 per person. So in sum, if you've obtained health insurance through the marketplace, you will have several more forms to fill out when you file your federal income tax return this year.
Another question, what should a taxpayer do if he or she gets an incorrect W-2 form and the employer simply will not issue a corrected W-2 form?
Marty, this actually happens more than one might think, but basically, if your employer refuses to issue you a corrected W-2 and it's after February 14th, you can request that an IRS representative initiate what's called a Form W-2 complaint. You can call the IRS at their customer service number, which is 800-829-1040, or you can visit one of the IRS Taxpayer Assistance Centers in person. And basically, the IRS will send your employer a letter requesting that they furnish you a corrected W-2 within 10 days. The IRS will also send you a letter with instructions as well as Form 4852. And you can actually use this form in the event that your employer does not provide you with the corrected W-2 in time to file your tax return. So basically, you would use that Form 4852 when you're filing your tax return to estimate what your income and your withholding was for the year. In the event that you eventually do get your W-2 and maybe it doesn't match what you reported, you may need to file an amended Form 1040X tax return in order to correct any incorrect information on your original return.
Okay. Well, could you briefly explain to us whether a taxpayer will be charged interest and penalty for filing and paying taxes late?
Typically, the answer is yes. So there is a late filing penalty and a late paying penalty. They're separate penalties that the IRS will issue. You're not issued penalties if you file your tax return late and you're due a refund. But if you file your taxes late with a balance due and you pay your taxes late, you will be subject to both penalties. And I just want to mention here that filing an extension gives you more time to file a tax return and still be considered timely, but it does not extend the time that you have to pay any balance due. So even if you got an extension, which for individuals would give you until October 15th to file your tax return, you do still need to prepay your tax by April 15th if you anticipate owing a balance, even if you filed an extension, because you still could be hit with some penalties.
And finally, where can people get help with income tax problems?
Well, that's an easy question, Marty. They can come to CTLP. They can contact us by phone at 804-358-5855, or they can go to our website at www.ctlp.org. We do represent low-income taxpayers that have controversies with either the IRS or the Virginia Department of Taxation, and we also provide brief advice. So if you have some quick questions that you'd like answered about your federal or state income taxes, we are happy to help.
Well, thank you very much. We have been speaking with Nancy Borcari at the Nash. We have been speaking with Nancy Porcari at the Community Tax Law Project, giving you tax tips for your April 15, 2015 filing for tax year 2014. Thank you again for being on the show.
Thanks so much, Marty.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. What if you could electronically file your taxes for free? Join us next Wednesday at 12:30 p.m. for a public briefing to highlight Virginia Free File that provides free online federal and state income tax preparation and e-filing services to Virginia's lower and moderate income taxpayers, active duty military, students, and seniors. That's law for the rest of us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegberg.